In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with Francis Robinson. He is professor of the history of South Asia at University of London, and he is visiting the campus to give a talk. He will be speaking as part of the MillerCom series. We have had many of these speakers on this program over the years, so that we can bring them to an audience a little bit larger than the one that could attend the talks here in Champaign-Urbana. He'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 o'clock. This is in the Levis Faculty Center on the campus, on the third floor. It's on Illinois Street in Urbana. And as is the case with all these programs, they're free and open to the public, and anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome if you'd like to stop by. And, of course, here on the program, questions are welcome, too. And we will be talking here on this program about some of the ideas that he'll be sharing in his talk this afternoon, looking at a little bit of the history of Islam, and specifically looking at how it is over time that the kind of influence or focus has shifted. And I suppose the appropriate metaphor is the pendulum, because this does go back and forth between a kind of orientation by Muslims that says the important goal is the next world and moving toward the next world, between that sort of orientation and one that says, well, what happens in this world is important as well. And in particular, he makes the argument that within, say, the last couple of hundred years, the pendulum has swung in the this-worldly orientation, particularly because of, over that time, the growing influence of the West and Western powers in the Islamic world. We'll talk a little bit about how this has played out and perhaps what it means for the future of the Muslim world, and also relations between the Muslim world and the West. And, of course, questions here on the program are welcome as well. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So if you're here locally, use that number. We do also have the toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep our program moving. But, of course, anyone who is interested in calling is welcome to do that. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Yes, sir.
We appreciate it. To begin, it's worth making the point that, and I suppose in that Islam is no different than a lot of other faiths in this respect, that is, there has been over time this kind of tension, and it has gone back and forth between saying what's really important to us is where we are going, is the next world, it's not this one. And this idea that says, no, the way that we live our lives right now, it has spiritual significance, is important now. And this is something that has the major focus has shifted back and forth.
I think that's absolutely right. And I must say, I think you explained the situation very well. I think it's important to say that right at the beginning, and from the beginning, Islam was a faith of this-worldly action. Mm-hmm. And it was only as it came to develop that an otherworldly Sufism, as we call it, Islamic mysticism, began to develop. And the idea that, in a sense, there was a mystic way down which one travelled, finally trying to merge oneself with God in the long run. That these two tendencies have been in tension for much of Islamic history, and certainly for much of the earlier part of Islamic history. But from the 13th century, the emphasis began to move slightly towards the mystic end, particularly, on the one hand, as a result of a very powerful infusion of these ideas into Islamic poetry, which in an oral culture is the prime art form. Mm-hmm. But secondly, because of the massive expansion of Islam throughout the world and the inclusiveness of the otherworldly understanding of Islam, enabled Islam to interact very effectively with other ways of understanding God and draw those other ways into its frame. What happened over the past 200 years? You associated it particularly with the emergence of Western power in the Muslim world. I think it's very important to understand that the move towards this worldly Islam was already beginning before. So it's, if you like, it's not just a reaction to the Western presence, it's actually instinctive and there, and part of the internal dynamics of the faith, which are then set going even more strongly as they come to interact with the Western presence. Now, the one interesting thing I'd like to set alongside this is that this move towards an emphasis on, if you like, a faith of social action takes place not just in Islam. You can also find it in Hinduism, in Buddhism, in Sikhism, in the 19th and 20th centuries. So it's an interesting question. Why should this move to a faith of social action be common to several of the world's religions in the 19th and 20th century? It's not just an Islamic thing.
Well, and I think that you and other scholars have drawn some parallels between this movement and the Protestant Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
In what sense? Are these two things, do they express similar kinds of impulses?
I think they do. Many of the processes that one associates with, if you like, the newly developing Protestant soul, processes of reflection, of being able to get at the texts yourself, because print only emerges in the Muslim world in the 19th century, and the sacred texts are only translated, by and large, into indigenous languages in the 19th century. So a process which took place in 16th century Europe was also taking place in 19th and 20th century Muslim world, of people being able to engage with the texts themselves. And regarding, as you rightly already said, their achievements in being able to put that guidance into action on earth as, if you like, the measure of whether they were likely to achieve salvation or not.
Mm-hmm. Just for a moment, I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about, in sort of concrete terms, what it is we're talking about when we talk about a this-worldly orientation. Otherworldly, that's pretty clear. That means, essentially, people are saying what happens really to us in this world doesn't really is not as important as our individually polishing ourselves, spiritual perfection, working on what the next world is going to be. That's, in my mind, that's pretty clear what that means. But when you talk about a this-worldly orientation, are you talking about spiritual matters as they exist in this world, or are you talking about something that goes beyond that, that has to do in a larger sense with a remaking of the world as we find it?
I think that term is very well taken, remaking the world as we find it. In order to achieve salvation in this dispensation, you have to take God's witness and make it work on earth. And that means not just being a good boy or good girl. It means working for the good of humankind. In some of the classic contexts in the Islamist world, say of Egypt or of Pakistan, it means, say, setting up clinics, setting up schools. It means being charitable. It means making God's witness work on earth in your own community.
Hmm. Our guest here in this part of Focus 580, Francis Robinson, he's a professor of the history of South Asia at the University of London. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. He'll be talking this afternoon at 4. This is part of the MillerCom series. He'll also, by the way, be taking part in a panel discussion on global fundamentalisms that include a number of faculty here from the University of Illinois. This is taking place at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, 1st of February, in the Humanities Lecture Hall at IPRH on West Pennsylvania. And I'm assuming, again, anybody who is interested in attending that should feel welcome. Same thing with the talk this afternoon, the MillerCom event. Questions welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation, starting with someone in Urbana, and this is line one. Hello.
Hello. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was Jacob's sons, Ishmael and I can't remember the other gentleman's name, but who split up and who fostered the division of religions. But my question is, Jesus once described himself as the Lamb of God, and Lamb is kind of embedded in the word Islam. Is there any connection of the his religion and the Islamic religion?
There are connections, but the connection doesn't exist with the LAM that exists in Islam. And in fact, you make a very interesting point when you talk about Isaac, there was a name you'd forgotten, I think, and Ishmael. As far as the Muslims are concerned, they're descended in exactly the same way as the Jews and the Christians are from Isaac. Isaac had two sons, Abraham had two sons, we'll go back. They're all descended from Abraham. Abraham had two sons, one Isaac, one Ishmael. From Isaac, the line goes down to the Jews and to the Christians. From Ishmael, who was Abraham's son through his wife Sarah, his concubine Sarah, the line goes down to the Arabs, to the Muslims. And I don't know if you know anything about the practices of the pilgrimage at Mecca, but all those practices actually celebrate what happened to Ishmael, when he and Sarah were cast out by Abraham into the desert. You may recall that one of the big celebrations of the pilgrimage is rushing backwards and forwards in order to pick up water. And this celebrates Sarah's desperate search for water, and it was actually found at the foot of where she had laid down Ishmael, and that's the Well of Zamzam in Mecca. So there are close connections, but not actually in the name.
Well, I thank the caller. Let's go to someone else here. We have someone in Champaign, and it's line number two. Hello.
Hello. Well, first of all, I think you meant to say Hagar instead of Sarah.
You're absolutely right. Thank you.
She was the concubine. Sarah.
You're
was
absolutely
the,
right. Hagar.
The wife.
Yep.
Right. Okay. So, my question has to do with this kind of I don't know what you call it. Kind of a continuum between otherworldliness and worldliness, in terms of. I mean, I guess you're saying that people are concerned about social action and people are concerned about this world, but people are also willing to blow themselves up because they feel that they will be martyrs and go to heaven, some of them, not all of them, mm-hmm. maybe very few of them, maybe a small minority, or people are willing to go and vote at the risk of being blown up, feeling that they've maybe just done their national duty, but maybe also done a religious duty that they might feel that they have done something really good and that they will be rewarded for it if they happen to get blown up at the polling station. So I guess that's one question I have about this continuum or how this works. But also I'm interested in how we have almost this dynamic of two fundamentalisms kind of grating up against one another, with U.S. fundamentalism and Islamic fundamentalism and certain beliefs about Israel in the future and whatnot. So I guess I'm wondering about kind of messianic fundamentalism, although socialism, which is very much concerned with the material in this world, could be almost messianic and could be involved in terrorism. So I'm interested in these kinds of ideas, if you might discuss them in some way.
Okay. Well, I think there's a whole bunch of things there. So will you forgive me if I just choose one or two?
That's fine.
You were interested in how, for instance, suicide bombers might be related to this worldly faith. I regard, if you like, the jihad, as you probably know the term pretty well, means right. Struggling in the way of the Lord. And that, if you like, is a driving force of this worldly faith. But, of course, it belongs, as you say, using your word continuum, it's part of a very considerable continuum. At one end, it's actually struggling with your own problems, your own weaknesses, in order to be a good believer. At another end, it can mean taking extreme action in order to, as far as you understand it, further the purposes of your faith. So I regard those who blow themselves up in taking as a suicide bomb as belonging right to the extreme end of struggling in the way of their faith. And of course they believe that they will attain heaven as a result, although there are many Muslim ulama and muftis who would say that they would not.
Okay. Going back to this idea of the, maybe material isn't the right word to use, but if you look at some of the architecture of the Ottoman Empire or of, you know, the Taj Mahal, of course, that's a little bit later, but some of the beautiful, let's say, in Central Asia, where you might have a mystical tradition, and yet you have, you know, all of this beauty and all of this finery that's, you know, built in order to perhaps make you think of the highest things, such as God. I'm just wondering, I mean, on the one hand, there might have been a lot of materialism in the Ottoman Empire, a lot of pomp and circumstance, but yet you also have a Sufism. Maybe those were in opposition in some way. Maybe there's some point of contact. Maybe you could talk about that as well, and then I'll let you go.
Well, I like the way that you bring the Taj in. It is an absolutely stunning building. I don't know if you've seen it. I strongly recommend it. For everyone, it's more stunning when they see it than ever they imagine it will be. But if you examine the Taj and look at all the calligraphed verses from the Quran that are around it and look at its structure, it's actually designed as the doors are designed to be the gates of heaven, and there's all the key chapters of the Quran relating to judgment are repeated there. And on the one hand, it's a place of great beauty, if you like, representing the throne of heaven. But on the other hand, if you think of what's actually being said, quite terrifying.
I want to pick up on the point that you know, the Quran raises and that you discuss. And if you start with the idea that for a person of faith, a this worldly orientation is not a bad thing, because what it says is that it places upon that person an obligation to try and leave the world a better place than they found it. So one would have to say on the face of it, that's good. However, if we have a kind of a movement that is so broad that it can encompass everyone from people who are doing humanitarian work to people who are militant in the extreme, it seems difficult to understand how it is that both, how do you accommodate both extremes?
I think you accommodate, it depends what you mean by accommodation. I think all extremes are expressed through here because, in a sense, you're dealing with a fifth, a quarter of the human race who are placed in a wide range of different contexts. And so, to some degree, the line and action that you might take in making your faith live on earth might, to some degree, not wholly, to some degree, be related to the specific context in which you find yourself. And for some people, however unpleasant it may be, and neither you or I experienced the problems of colonial rule and having all your life chances very, very considerably constrained, actually taking violent action may seem actually one of the better ways of operating. Indeed, our Prime Minister's wife, Cherie Blair, was actually in an unwise moment heard to say so in public.
Is there within Islam a debate going on now?
Is there what?
A debate going on now over just which action is the more appropriate?
There's a constant debate going on all the time. There are large numbers of Muslims who deeply disapprove of violence, who can only see a way forward through constructive, constructive itself is interpretable, but can only see ways forward through forms of peaceful action. So there's a constant debate. It's vigorously debated. That said, it's sometimes quite hard for some people to stand up and speak out loud and condemn, perhaps, as they would like to. But I can assure you it's vigorously debated. I am part of my... I'm not a Muslim, but I engage quite a lot with my own Muslim community on my own university campus in London. And this sort of thing is a subject of constant debate. And I have to say they come out very much on the ironic, peaceful end of the debate.
How much of this is a function of class, of social class? I think I read a paper that you wrote where you talked about the fact that it definitely, that the kind of militant Islam that we have seen tends to be a relatively middle and lower middle class kind of movement.
I think that's true. To some considerable, but not wholly so. The shock troops of this movement in our sort of classic understanding are usually first generation people who moved from the countryside to the city. These are the large numbers of supporters of Islamist groups throughout the world. And of course, the Islamic world has seen a massive process of urbanization over the past 30 or 40 years. And Islamism itself, in that context, often provides all the physical supports in terms of schooling, social centres, clinics and so on, but also psychological support that enables people to make that very big transition from one social environment to another socioeconomic environment.
I'm asking a question that invites a generalization, but I'm interested in how people, as you see it, how people in the Muslim world today, particularly people who are involved in these kinds of movements that are basically about creating an Islamic society, how they engage with the modern world or perhaps reject the modern world. I think there's this assumption that there is a very strong strain of anti-modernism, and that I'm sure some scholars would look at that and say, well, that's not that that is not inevitable that that should be. There's no reason really why Islam should not be a modern faith, or Muslims should not be modern people. There's nothing per se in Islam that should say that that should not be.
Let's get it absolutely straight. Islamism, or Islamists, what people often call fundamentalists, are in many ways profoundly modern, and they seek profoundly modern ends. I just come back from Iran, and in Iran, high technology is embraced in every possible way. In many ways, I find Iran more computerized than my own world in Britain. So there's no problem in technological modernity. Indeed, many of the leaders of Islamist movements are doctors, engineers, teachers, large support amongst university students, people who are highly educated and modern in that sense. So, and equally, many of those who've come to study Islamist groups and the kinds of impacts that it's been having on individuals have come to note that they increasingly seem to support, strangely enough, forms of individualism. They support, they profoundly oppose all forms of patronage. They only want progress by merit. That there's increasing respect for individual human space and all this kind of thing, as against family requirements. That much of what one sees taking place within the framework of what seems to us in many ways quite threatening is actually producing, in inverted commas, modern individuals as we understand them.
There is a major, one can hardly understate it, difference in the way now that Europe and the United States are approaching Iran. The Europeans seem to be trying to engage Iran in a constructive way, using diplomacy, talking. The United States is being much more belligerent, and among the things we have seen reported in the news lately is that the United States is at least scouting targets for possible military action against Iran and its nuclear infrastructure. And it seems that the United States, at least, seems to be skeptical about a great deal of doubt about what the Europeans can achieve with their strategy. Do you think, in a sense, this is perhaps more of a political question, do you think that there has been some success, that is, that Europe has had some success in trying to establish a relationship with the government of Iran?
Well, certainly I think we have, because I've done a great deal myself in dealing both with the Iranian foreign ministry and with the Iranian Ministry of Higher Education. We've done a great deal of work in building research, joint research projects with Iranian universities, with developing joint teaching programs, both at undergraduate and postgraduate level, with Iranian universities. And it's my view that by engaging in many different ways at this level, we actually help the reformers in Iran and help slowly bring Iran back into the system. There's certainly a very considerable desire amongst large numbers of Iranians to come back into the system in a major way. I have to say, though, that I think it would be disastrous if any military action, aggressive action of any kind, was undertaken in relation to Iran. Iran is slowly, in its own way, working out its destiny. Aggressive action would lead to a huge surge of Iranian nationalism and actually set back the process of slow, crabwise change that is taking place at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you one further question, and I have a couple of callers that will get to them. I want to make sure they know I'm not going to make them wait forever. But I suspect that there are probably a lot of people in the West who look at Iran and they see that there are a number of Iranians who are concerned about the religious rule of their country, would like to have a different kind of government, people that we often talk about as being reformers, whatever that means. Maybe in some people's minds there is the assumption that for those people they're interested in Iran being a secular state, a secular democracy. And I think that probably we have to be very careful in applying terms that come from American politics to another society that's different. What even if you take those people who would like to see a more secular society, and that is one that is not so firmly in control of religious leaders, what sort of society would they like to have, and what sort of role in that society would religion play?
I think one thing enormously important to understand about Iran is that Shia faith is a very strong part of the national identity. The Shah's regime from the 1920s through to 1979 endeavoured to build a secular alternative. But Shia faith is a very profound part, and all the images and iconography of Shiism are a very important part of Iranian national identity. So although, as I'm sure will eventually happen, something infinitely more secular will emerge in Iran, and arguably the so-called fundamentalists are actually helping it on the way by being what they are. Nevertheless, Shiism will be a part of the Iranian national identity. And, of course, the great art is actually to find what place for it can be found in a more secular Iranian world. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Francis Robinson. He's professor of the history of South Asia at the University of London. He will be giving a talk about some of the ideas that we've discussed here, particularly the things we were talking about at the beginning, about this balance between otherworldly and this worldly piety and how it is that within, say, the last couple of hundred years, the pendulum has swung more to the this-worldly kind of orientation. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon, 4 o'clock, at the Leva Center on the U of I campus. It's a MillerCom event. It's free and open to anybody who would like to attend. Otherwise, here on the program, of course, we're open to questions, and we have several people who are ready. We will get right back to the phones, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Pena is the first in line here, line number one.
Hello.
Yes.
I find your program seems to be very truthful and full of reality, and I think we need to see what can be done with the administration to face this reality, which I think they've ignored, and that's one reason why we're in a lot of trouble over in the Eastern world. Also, would you make mention of the Antichrist and Armageddon? Thank you.
No, I'm afraid I'm not really equipped to discuss the Antichrist and Armageddon. I'm sorry.
Well, we'll go on. Next is line number two. This is a caller in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I've enjoyed the discourse so far. I have a question. We frequently read in our newspapers the term theocracy as defining the government of Iran. Is that in the Western concept of theocracy, or is it something else? And does this theocracy, so-called, stem from Zoroastrianism, or what is the belief system? I'd like to comment that I concur and it really enjoyed your statement about the advances and the accomplishments of the civilization over there. And when I studied architectural history several years ago at the University of Illinois, I learned that the vaulting system used in medieval times throughout Europe began in Iraq and Iran. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Well, a lot of our maths is actually originally derived from the Arab world, which is why we can find those similarities. There's nothing to do with Zoroastrianism here, but you would be right to describe the government of Iran as a theocracy, in the sense that the people who have the last word are people we call the ulama. You'll have heard of Ayatollahs and so on. Those are the Islamic scholars. And all legislation that goes through the Iranian parliament, which is an elected parliament, has nevertheless to go before a group of Islamic scholars for judicial review. And they decide whether this legislation is properly Islamic or not, or they give it its Islamic polish. So it is a theocracy in the sense that the law gets finally signed off by a group of Islamic scholars, and of course, in theory, the most powerful man in the system, a man called the Supreme Guide, Ayatollah Khamenei, as he is in effect the person who has the last say on almost all matters.
Here in the United States, we have, although it's something that we argue a good deal about, this notion that there should be a separation of church and state. And I think in much of the Muslim world, that's not the idea. In fact, they would say that you cannot separate society, government, and the faith. They're so closely integrated that that's just they wouldn't even accept the notion. However, there certainly are places where there does seem to be more distance between the faith and the government. I mean, what really determines just how close those two worlds are?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, arguably, for much of Muslim history, there's been quite a substantial separation between, if you like, the world of Islam and the ulama, and the world of the shahs or the sultans. Mm-hmm. In a sense, And it's always been a very important issue for Islamic political theory, the extent to which a Shah should rule completely by himself and the extent to which he should actually acknowledge the requirements of Islamic law. And so for Islamic political theorists, there was the issue, can a Muslim ruler actually go to heaven? So it's, for much of Islamic history, it's been a key issue, and the Shahs, if you like, the kings, have more often than not had the upper hand. It's really changed over the past 200 years, and in large part with, if you like, the movement of the masses into the political arena. And particularly with the development of Islamism and Islamic understandings which said, in order to create an Islamic society, we must capture the modern state. But for much of Islamic history, the state belonged to the king, the law belonged elsewhere, the religious law belonged elsewhere.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone listening in Urbana on line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, I tuned in late, but I had a couple questions. Did your guest mean has he explained yet why there's this shift between from otherworldly to this worldly emphasis?
Well, I'm quite happy quickly to do so, if that would be helpful.
Sure.
In the Islamic world, there's always been this tension between otherworldly and thisworldly Islam. There was an increasing movement towards thisworldly Islam in the 18th century. And then between 1800 and 1920, all of the Muslim world, or almost all of it, came under Western rule. And in that context, there was a great shift towards a thisworldly faith. So actually, it is profoundly related, although not wholly related, to the experience of colonial rule, and arguably the introduction of forms of Western capitalism and so on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Actually, the person that was interviewed just before you, I was trying to get through to, but I failed because... he said that, well, first of all, when you were talking about this world, and you said, you know, charitable activities and orphanages and schools and all that, that really reminded me of the early history of Osama bin Laden himself. The first time I looked into his history, it was full of that kind of stuff, his works in Afghanistan I'm really not able to list all the places, but this last person that was interviewed, he said to the question, why do you think we haven't been attacked since 9/11? He said, I think the world has been going in the direction of Osama bin Laden since 9/11, unquote. And I wanted to ask him about that, but I was wondering if, since you've now alluded to it, an earlier period where colonial activity had the effect of, that you talked of, and now our intervention, would you also agree that Osama bin Laden is seen as a very... a very forward icon in the Muslim world, as this last person would have said?
Yes, I think he has tremendous respect amongst many in the Muslim world for the simple reason that he has stood up in whatever, however unpleasant the way in which he did so, he has appeared to stand up for Muslim pride and respect. I think it's enormously important to remember that large numbers of Muslims feel that the West has no or very little respect for them. And unfortunately, that has been replicated, for instance, by the way in which we failed to account the number of Iraqis killed in the war. Moving to another point which you made, you suggested that, in a sense, or that the previous interviewee had said that the world was moving in Osama bin Laden's direction. I fear that our intervention in Iraq, and I say our because I speak as a Briton, has actually made many, many more supporters for the understandings of Osama bin Laden, not only in Iraq, but throughout the Muslim world. I don't know, sir, if you travel to the Muslim world, but if you do, I recommend that you go into bazaars, around, look at the back of shops, and look at the pictures that are up at the back. And I suspect you'll see Osama bin Laden's picture there more often than not.
Yeah, there's a very poor understanding in this country of just how much character there is in the Muslim world. I mean, if character is doing the right thing, despite the personal pain and cost, then surely the Muslim world is really full of character, I would say. And one last thing, and I'll hang up, and that is that it is key, isn't it, not that apparently the top three sacred sites of the Muslim world are now being either under Western control or under Western attack, and that's a very key thing.
Well, I don't think Mecca and Medina are under Western control. You could say that Jerusalem was under a form of Western control, that being the third.
Well, the argument is that we support the Saudis, and the Saudis are corrupt, and that we have bases in Saudi Arabia, and therefore, you know, have tainted the sacred land and that kind of thing.
Okay, I understand that. You've clearly been reading Osama bin Laden, sir.
Well, actually, the British papers.
Okay.
Which you know, has been a little bit more, they've been a little bit more willing to delve into the nuances. But anyway, I'll hang up on
that. Right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on to another caller. This is Champagne in line one. Hello.
Hi. If I could go back to your discussion about Iran and Iran having nuclear weapons and the general nationalism of Iran, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about if Iran had nuclear weapons, aren't there issues about what the aggressive policies of Iran would then be, both in terms of Saudi Arabia, other powers in the Gulf area, maybe to the east and north in terms of the Soviet Union, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, but also towards the west in terms of Israel, and whether there's, given the aggressive policies of Iran in the past, supporting terrorism against the United States and against all those other places, what would happen when they had nuclear weapons and were continuing the aggressive policies, which they have done in the last 10, 20 years, no question about it.
Interesting. First of all, let me say I'd rather that Iran didn't have nuclear weapons. On the other hand, looking at it from Iran's point of view, I would feel rather threatened by the nuclear weapons which Israel possesses.
Uh-huh.
And indeed, though relations normally are pretty good between Pakistan and Iran, the nuclear weapons which Pakistan possesses. So I think Iran has a duty to its own people to assure their security. The reason why I'd rather Iran didn't have nuclear weapons is that there remains possibly a danger that they could move into the wrong hands. Not that Iran would hand them over to terrorists, but the wrong kinds of people might take control of the Iranian state. I think that's highly unlikely, but it's possible. That said, my own belief is that Iran is in its current policies in West Asia, is actually a source of stability rather than instability, and that we, both in Europe and in the States, should be trying to engage with that source of stability and bring it on side, rather than threaten it and destabilize it.
Well, if I could just say, you say it's a source of stability, but there's no doubt they funded terrorism, Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has destabilized part of that area. They funded the bombing of American bases in Saudi Arabia, which is, the evidence is very clear now, though we didn't do anything at the time because the evidence wasn't clear. And there's lots more that they've done in other parts of the world. So they have used their funding for terrorism. Would they do more if they were had a nuclear weapon and felt more invulnerable?
I think Iran is actually in the process of moving on side. The intervention through Hezbollah and the Lebanon belongs to some years ago. I have to say I'm not aware of Iranian involvement in the attacks on American bases in Saudi Arabia. I recognize the danger of Iran having nuclear weapons. I'd rather it didn't. But I think our task, as I said, is to try and work with Iran and bring her into our fold and not threaten and try and destabilize her.
Thank you.
All right. We'll try and get one more caller. This would be Urbana, line two. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. David, I'd like to comment on your earlier questions. Implicit in this was that, to the guest, was that Islam is medieval and anti-modernity. It all depends what you call modernity. I mean, to me, if modernity is having less clothes on one's body or to be engaged in lewd behavior or to let pornography flourish under the freedom of expression and to have disrespect for the parents and lack of respect for the institution of marriage, then, of course, you would not find Islam to be there. But if you're talking about modernity from an Islamic standpoint, on the contrary, women in Muslim countries have held highest posts in the government and public affairs in contemporary times and in history, too. Inheritance rights of women, the rights to express opinions or vote and engage in intellectual discussion, the right to earn and spend as they wish are embedded in Islamic doctrine and practices. If this is not modernity in your understanding, then I don't know what else constitutes modernity. It is the injustice and the disenfranchisement in our current world which fuels what we see around us today. Hmm. We as global citizens have a role to play. And not look at the world from, say, at a higher plane in coming and passing judgments. Unless me and you and others do that, we unfortunately will continue to find ourselves in this sad state of affairs. Hmm. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, I appreciate the comment. I would also like to say, by the way, that I was not meaning to suggest that I personally felt that Islam was medieval or anti-modern.
No, I mean, you were expressing conveying a feeling which is prevalent there, and I just wanted to add that this all should be looked at from a larger perspective. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. You want to make any comment on that?
Just to say that I actually agree with much of what the caller has said.
We have a couple of minutes left. There's an idea that I'd like you at least to touch on that I find interesting, and that is in observing this trend towards this worldly piety in Islam, there is this, it becomes incumbent on the individual, Muslim, to do what he or she can do to improve the world. I'm interested in something that you hint on in a paper that you wrote that I read about how this may tend to foster a kind of individualism that perhaps we had not seen before. After all, as what Islam means, it means submission. It means submission to God. Do you see, in fact, as a kind of result of this focus on this world, is there a growing sense of individualism that had not been there before? And if that is the case, what are the implications?
Yes, there is. I take this back to two things. One, a sense of individualism, if you like, goes with the very high level of personal responsibility. that this worldly Islam places on the individual. It is your actions, it's how you behave, which decides whether you're going to make it to heaven or not. And that sense of personal responsibility also comes to breed a sense of personal empowerment as well. And it's absolutely fascinating to see this being worked out, in fact, in literature, say, as written by, particularly by women in India and Pakistan over the past 100 years. So, yes, a sense of individualism, a sense of personal responsibility. And I think the very interesting thing is that this, of course, brings about a tension between, if you like, on the one hand, the individual's sense of personal responsibility and their growing sense of personal empowerment on the one hand, and, of course, the requirements of the faith submission, as you said, on the other. And I think one of the most fruitful areas for investigation is actually to see the ways in the modern Muslim world in which those tensions between the requirements of the faith and this new sense of personal empowerment felt by women just as much as by men are being worked out.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Our guest, Francis Robinson, professor of the history of South Asia at the University of London. He'll be talking this afternoon, 4 o'clock, as part of the Millercom series. This is at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. It's free and open to the public. Anybody is welcome.